there are some things the state cannot do to direct the moral content of your life, and controlling your sexuality is one of those things.
I'm Catherine Mengu Ward for Reason TV, and I'm here today talking with Dale Carpenter about his new book, Flagrant Conduct, The Story of Lawrence v. Texas. Thank you for talking with us.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Just as a kind of background, give me a quick summary of the case and why it matters.
The case was it's a decision of the Supreme Court that struck down the Texas homosexual conduct law, which forbade specified sexual activities between two people of the same sex. And in doing so, the Supreme Court said that this violated the constitutional right to liberty, which includes a right to adult intimacy and privacy.
Your book is about the story behind the story, in particular that the case was presented, and certainly before I read your book, I had this gauzy idea that it was kind of two men in a committed relationship who were, you know, just like the straight folks, except for unfairly targeted by the law. Explain why that narrative was both useful and false.
Well, it was useful because that sort of narrative was a way for the court to understand the case such that it would be acceptable constitutionally. It would be like protecting people who are in a committed relationship. And the court had come to have a different understanding, I think, of gay people over time because the justices were more familiar with having gay clerks and neighbors and friends. It was a false story, I think, because I don't believe the police actually saw anybody having sex, and in fact, I don't believe the two men were having sex. And the gay rights attorneys, quite justifiably, allowed the case to proceed on the basis of the allegations of the police.
Set the scene for us a little bit. You know, I think it's hard, even in 2012, to really understand how much attitudes toward homosexuality have evolved from kind of the stage on which this case takes place.
Well, the sodomy laws in the United States had gone back from the founding and before the founding to the colonies, but they had always covered both opposite sex and same sex activity and were not just limited to gay people. In the 1970s, some states like Texas began narrowing their laws to focus solely on intimacy between two people of the same sex and making only that criminal, but allowing others to have their own right to privacy and sexual autonomy. That came out, I think, of an atmosphere of real stigma attached to gay men and lesbians all across the country, but especially in places like Texas. And it came out in the fact that the legislature refused to repeal the law, even though it was asked to do so in every session. Courts refused to strike it down because people were not actually getting arrested. And the law was used to brand gay men and lesbians as criminals, and therefore as a basis to deny them jobs, housing, you name it, across the board.
You tell a great little story about, right as the oral arguments are about to take place, a sort of tip that the lawyer gets about Sandra Day O'Connor. Can you retell that story for us?
The attorney for Lambda Legal, which was the national gay rights group that led the challenge against the Texas sodomy law, was about to get up and deliver his oral argument to the justices back in March 2003. And it's a high-pressured moment for anyone, but especially for this man in this case. And just before he gets up to deliver his argument, someone whispers into his ear that Justice O'Connor had just sent a former clerk of hers and her lesbian partner a baby shower gift since they had had a baby. That really encapsulates the changes that had occurred on the court by the year 2003, when all of the justices knew someone who was gay, in contrast to 17 years before, when the court had upheld sodomy laws in a case called Bowers versus Hardwick, and one of the justices told his clerk that he had never met someone who was gay, even though that clerk turns out to himself have been a closeted gay person. So the case is just full of ironies and little twists throughout.
Talk a little bit about why this case is about more than just gay rights.
Well, in in part, it's about more than that because it revives a constitutional doctrine that protects a right to liberty and privacy and sexual autonomy for adults. It's a limitation on the power of government to intrude on our personal lives. It says there are some things the state cannot do to direct the moral content of your life, and controlling your sexuality is one of those things.
Can you talk a little bit about the kind of stagecraft of these Supreme Court cases? I mean, what struck me was just how incredibly powerful the lawyers, the attorneys who kind of shape the case, shape the public's perception of the case, how powerful they are in rewriting the life stories of these men. I mean, Lawrence had a long-term boyfriend who was not involved in this case at all, and this person is sort of erased from the story among other people. You know, is your kind of sense that that's very common, and that much of what we hear and see coming out of the court is this narrowed kind of narrative, or was there something special about this case?
Well, I think both of those things are true, actually. It's common for the court only to get a very distilled essence of the facts, which it then reviews to determine things like constitutionality. The court does not often get into the weeds of the facts of a case. And in this case, the court was not encouraged to do so, in part because there was no trial. The police made a charge. They arrested the two men, dragged them out of their home, took them off to jail, fined them, and did so on the basis of what I believe were false charges. But the gay rights attorneys had no interest in challenging the factual allegations made by the state. So everyone's interest was in seeing this version of the case proceed through the courts, the police not wanting to admit that it wasn't true, gay rights attorneys wanting a challenge involving the application of such a law in a private space. And our legal system, it turns out, our criminal justice system, is not a search for truth. It is not an inquisitorial system. We don't have an inquisitor who demands answers from criminal defendants. Instead, we have an adversarial system. And sometimes that adversarial system works to ferret out the truth, and sometimes that adversarial system assumes a kind of alternate truth that then becomes the basis for a larger decision.
So the court is essentially almost deciding a hypothetical, but it doesn't matter because this is the question that people want the court to answer. This is what the court is for.
Right. I would say you could certainly describe it as a hypothetical, although in this case, because the men were actually arrested, that arrest was not hypothetical, and the charges that were made against them were not hypothetical. And the problem that the litigants had was that the police weren't using this law to arrest people in the privacy of their home. And judges were requiring that happen before you could challenge the law. And yet, the law was having an effect throughout society. So it was, you in a sense had to get around that technical requirement of having to get arrested to get at the meat of the law. I don't think the attorneys ever misrepresented anything. The police may have represented something in the facts of the case, and the attorneys allow that to proceed and took full advantage of it.
Thank you very much, Dale Carpenter.
Thank you.
For Reason TV, I'm Catherine Mengue Ward.